the principal barriers to assimilation seems to be the natural tendency of white people to violence. They love violence. They love it as entertainment, the very foundation of their way of life. Death and sacrifice. White people, with almost missionary zeal, have done their best to export death and sacrifice to every corner of the world.
Hi there. This is Elena Ortiz calling in from Ogopogo, otherwise known as Occupied Santa Fe. Red Power Hour is back with myself and Sina Ramani and Jugmanitu, who are wonderful comrades from the Red Nation. And Sina also is our producer and hosts his own podcast, The East is a Podcast. They're going to be joining me today to talk about Dune. Been looking forward to this for a very long time. Melanie Yazzie, Dr. Mel, is traveling. She's on a walkabout right now. She'll be back for an episode soon. We have upcoming episodes on reproductive justice in light of the Supreme Court opinion, which was secretly released about the possible repeal of Roe v. Wade. So we'll be talking about reproductive justice. We're also going to talk about Avatar at some point, but today we're going to talk about the film Dune, and this is going to be a lot of fun because love it, hate it, hate it, and love it. It is an interesting film to talk about. So take it away.
No, I can't take it away.
My name is Shimani too.
Okay, I will start then. I'm not sure, but I'm going to say this. Maybe the oldest one here. So the first book came out the year I was born, so I didn't read it then, but I read it when I was in high school and saw the first film, which was pretty awful. The only redeeming quality of the first Dune film was seeing Sting greased up in his underwear, totally homoerotic elements to that movie with the Baron Harkonnen. In fact, I'm almost cringing thinking about it right now.
I totally wrote down they need to add Sting into the next movie.
There wasn't enough homoeroticism in this movie. We got to go back and find Sting in his underwear and the Baron with his young boys. The books really deserved a better film, and I'm not sure this is it. And when I say better, I mean there's a lot to unpack in these, including, as we were just talking about, the Orientalism, the anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, a lot of that. And Frank Herbert himself was an anti-imperialist and anti-colonialist, but he was also a white man. And so his anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism is really... it really comes out in this movie as colonialism itself is the only way to save people from colonialism. So there's a lot to talk about. The other thing that's interesting about the books that I wish we saw more of in the movie is this idea of Muslim futurism or Islamic futurism, which we would have gotten more of, except they sanitized it in this film. And not sure why, other than this is not the time or the empire here in the so-called United States to elevate Islam as the saviors of the world from imperialism, capitalism, colonialism. So lot to unpack. Anyway.
Elena, I think that I have a question for you. So you know the novel and you know that. So I don't know how much you know Shugmanitu, but we have at least one full-blown expert on this textual enterprise, but they're... a part of it, I think the way to go in, because, I mean, of course, I'd heard about Herbert. I'd heard about this text. I was never a fan. I haven't read the book. I haven't seen the David Lynch version. I barely got through this one. It was...
don't watch the David Lynch version.
But I've heard a lot about it. There's a lot of things, a text that I've, experienced, criticism about that I've never consumed, that, it's just... so Dune is kind of one of these kind of footnotes of interesting... you know, it is an institution, and a lot of cultural aspects of, the U.S., sort of late capitals, there is a franchise built around it too, right? Like I think just from the little that I've read on Wikipedia, that the inheritors of his estate, his son and some other guy, have like kept the machine going, like everything else, like it turned into an intellectual property that kind of cornered a specific market. So Elena, I guess you're the perfect age for this text. Well, maybe you were a little bit young when it came out, but
yeah,
it's a kind of mid boomer science fiction, like beloved canonical text that has remained in the realm of the nerds 100%. I know we live in like nerd era, that like the hegemony of the nerd has really risen, but like it's not like Star Wars. Like it's not, it is a very niche thing, I would say. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay, so that's an interesting thing though, is like, when did Star Wars really propel itself into like mainstream popularity? Yeah. Like a lot of people watched it, but like the people who fueled its economy and ultimately its growth were the niche nerds who are like, I want to collect all the toys and stuff as a 40-year-old person when the prequels comes out. And Dune sort of lives on in that tradition, the niche cult followings that like really dedicate their lives more so to following it. Like Big Bang Theory definitely does like a good encapsulation of like nerds that would like obsess with that kind of like, you know, obscure stuff. And like they go dressed as the worm or something to a Halloween party. It's that kind of person that would be willing to do a group costume as the, I always forget that I don't remember how to say the worm's name, but I would, yeah. Whatever, but the giant worm, the old man of the desert is the English translation. Shia Lube.
I'm so glad, Elena. I'm so glad you know this. This is so good. I feel like I can talk to like a monastic figure who studied these holy texts.
Because I read this all as a kid, but like my dad was a boomer that like made me read all the stuff he liked to as a kid, and like I was reading Stephen King and crap in sixth grade. Oh,
I think these are kind of staples of American cultural life more than. Of course, American cultural life is international just because of the force of Hollywood. But Dune, I still would say, resides in a pretty niche domain. Now, the thing with fandom now and like kind of global fandom and the internet, the most niche thing in the world can have millions of people who love it to death, right? Who celebrate it, who like have this whole machine around it. So anyways, that was kind of my initial thing to kind of talk about. Yeah, the Orientalism, we definitely have to get into. The text is seeping in it. It's like a maple syrup tree that's just, it's just been tapped multiple times and it's oozing out of every inch of itself. This is what mid-60s, right? So it's kind of neocolonialism is in the air. Like, how do we manage these newly liberated lands that have all this oil wealth? I mean, this is like the emergence of what's now called like the Gulf, the Persian Gulf countries that were all basically just like oil emirates that were... Obviously, the heavy-handedness of like spice being this really heavy-handed thing of oil plus also cocaine as like a mix of
spice is like psychedelic petroleum, right? Yeah. So it's a cross between oil and drugs,
right? Yeah,
I'm gonna say in the '60s, though, you know, not only was the oil like a major factor in interventions and wars. But you had the Banana Republics, you had cocaine, heroin. I mean, the heroin was just starting with the Vietnam War, but that was a major influence. So the combination of these, drug meets fuel, that's the sci-fi explanation for their fuel travel is that there's these navigator beings that like do the drug to help them focus on doing the calculations better. And
they literally fold space.
Yeah, then they fold space somehow psychedelic trip. It's like, okay.
That's the thing with this kind of generic laws of gravity that like in realism, right? Like a realist text, we would be forced to like, oh, okay, you have to put gas in a car and you have to travel or you go by plane, right? But like in worlds like this, you kind of are, you have the best of both worlds. You have everything to draw upon in terms of like the world, all of the difference in the world, like from Islam or, East Asian culture, you can just draw on that aesthetically, like how the words sound, how they come out of your mouth, how people are dressed. And you guys obviously can recognize that too in any sort of like Native American thing, right? Which is usually like a mishmash of different cliches that are kind of a projection of indigenousness onto other people. So That's what's...
Well, that's like Avatar.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's... So there's an interesting thing happening. You get the best of both worlds. You have realism. Like, you have all the things of, like, people falling in love and having emotions and people getting into fights. Like, all the things that, like, make us quote-unquote human, right? But then you don't have any of the laws of, like, the physical laws or the human, right? So you can just make up anything. And incidentally, I mean, I'm going to say this later, but, like, it's very funny to me that... Clearly, there's so much narrative detail that needs to be crammed into these movies. So there's all these like exposition scenes that are like, oh, I am explaining part of a movie that would be otherwise too hard and too expensive to show. Like, I love those aspects of it.
I would say, though, it does it a lot more subtly than the 1984 edition, like version, because so I'd say both movies appeal to fans, but in these polar opposite ways where, right. You know, the Lynch version is very silly, I would say. You know, it's very... It's
I'm not sure it's meant to be silly, though. That's the scary thing.
But the only reason I liked, like, ever watched it was because my dad said it was funny. That was it.
It was campy. You know,
it can't be. There you go. That's a better term for it. But then you have this new movie, which is very more ominous and serious with its presentation. Even the emperor, as he floats, you know, in the original one, he floats really quickly up. He doesn't have this long gown or anything. And when you first get introduced to him, he's just very flamboyant and boisterous. Whereas in this one, it's just ominous music. He rises up slowly. He has this long gown that's like, is that his body? Or, you know, you're not quite sure what's going on with him as a being. And then there's like fog and stuff coming around. So with as far as the cinematography and like, you know, the way they're appealing to fans, I think it's very interesting. But for anybody who doesn't know anything, it's the most confusing movie ever, especially with the visions that just jump to alternate futures that never come to existence.
And if you so boy, there's a lot. I mean, every time you say something, either one of you, I think of something else. Like in the books, they use the word jihad. So Herbert uses the word jihad, and this is a galactic jihad, right?
Oh my God.
They call it a galactic jihad. So they removed that. Well, they didn't use that term in either the Lynch film or this film. It's very much more coded towards Islam in the books than either one of the movies. And you know, you can understand why. But what's interesting is that it also draws from and I'm sure, Sina, you probably noticed this more than anyone, the words that they use, the phrases that they use, and some of them are, and my understanding, and I don't speak a word of Persian, some of them are drawn from Persian phrases, some of them are drawn from Arabic, some of them are even Hebrew, like the Kwisatz Haderach, which is what Paul Atreides is supposed to be, this Messiah, is actually drawn from the Talmud. And so it's Hebrew, but they draw all of these things together and they boil them down using whatever parts of Islam they want to. But it still ends up being a white savior film in that Paul Atreides is from an imperial family and he has been... They employ the Bene Gesserit, who I love, because, of course, they're a bunch of really badass women who are also messing around with eugenics to try to create this Messiah. And there's a lot more, I think, to come in the upcoming movies. But there's in the books, you really get an idea or a question of whether or not this prophecy was actually... created by the Bene Gesserit in order to control the galaxy. So right now, they're using it to create an uprising. They're using it to create jihad. They're using this idea of this Muad'Dib, this savior, to bring Arrakis and all of the valuable spice in Arrakis into power. But you're never really sure in the books whether or not this prophecy was planted in order for the Bene Gesserits to take over, ultimately. Right now, you've got a bunch of imperial forces. You've got the Harkonnens, and you've got the Atreides, and then you have the Emperor. They're warring it out like little marionettes trying to figure out who's going to control the psychedelic petroleum.
So, okay, maybe it might be useful for both of you, since you know the plot probably a lot better than me. Can you give us the general kind of like overview of the basic structure? Because I totally don't understand it. I think I do. This also was part one, and this is like a typical, this is like a sci-fi, you know, I mean, this is typical, especially more today, is that this was serialized into many parts, right? This was imagined as these many part adventure.
This is the that movie was the first half of the first book.
Okay. And were they published as, like, was he writing them as multiple sets of books, or did it grow the way that, like, say, Star Wars grew?
No, he definitely wrote the books as a series.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, okay. Maybe a bit of a plot overview that might help, because it is a lot to, sort of like overwhelm. I mean, the basic aspect of it is that there's this planet, Arrakis, that has this incredibly important, valuable resource, natural resource, and the indigenous people who live there are essentially ruled over by this thing called the Empire, right? Like it's just straight up called Imperial Decree or something.
So the Empire is obviously has an emperor, and then there are the houses, the royal houses. And the two that you see in the first movie are Atreides and Harkonnen. And Harkonnen had ruled Arrakis and had really subjected the Fremen, who are the indigenous people, to horrible treatment. They were subjugated. They were basically chased into hiding. They were used strictly as labor. They were never allowed any free voice, any self-government. The Harkonnens were brutal rulers, and spice production had slowed down because of the treatment of the Fremen by the Harkonnens. So the Padishah governor, their Padishah emperor, brings in House Atreides to rule, ostensibly because they want to up the production of spice, but also the Padishah emperor wants to create a war between House Atreides and House Harkonnen in order to better control Arrakis. Whoever controls Arrakis has to be firmly in the grip of the emperor. Then you have the Bene Gesserit sisterhood, this group of women who for thousands of years have been crossbreeding people between the great houses in order to create this, what they call the Kwisatz Haderach, which is the Messiah, the one who will lead the galaxy to freedom. And Paul Atreides is presented as a possible Kwisatz Haderach, but you really don't know that until the end of the book. So that's going to be in the second movie. But what you've got going on is like the Fremen are really the focus of the first book, because there's this sort of diaspora and there is this mistreatment of the indigenous people, and they are the indigenous people. And it was clear from Frank Herbert's writings that he patterned them as Bedouin. And they're the only ones who can survive in this desert. They've got this religion that's based around Shai Halub, which is the almighty, the worm, which creates the spice. So they are both indigenous. They have this spirituality and this government within the diaspora that is dangerous to the Padishah emperor. So he needs to have that destroyed, whether by benevolent colonialism, which would be House Atreides, who wants to respect the Fremen and learn from them, but still use their labor and not pay them for it, or Harkonnens, which just want to exploit them completely and kill them all.
Well, so I was going to say that as far as, you know, knowing whether or not he's the savior or not, there is a bit of foreshadowing in the beginning when they first arrive. And they'd like yell out, Lasan al-Ghaib, I think is how you'd say it.
Yep.
Okay, yeah, I didn't mess that one up. Which means giver of water, which I found, interesting, like how there's like this exploitation from the
Bezerits, right? Yeah, Bezerits. And how they had used their influence there to present them as a savior before they even arrived. But as far as like I'm a little jumping in to where I last heard things, but you were talking about his mother and their connection to the sisterhood and their eugenics efforts, and she had actually like gave birth to him without permission,
their restrictions.
Yeah, there we go. That's the word I want to say.
They told her, the Bene Gesserit mother told her, she was only allowed to bear daughters because a daughter could be married to a Harkonnen son and heal the rift between the two houses. But Jessica did not. She had. So apparently the Bene Gesserits can also dictate the sex of their child.
Yeah, they can choose it. They just can physically choose it with the voice, I'm guessing, is how they do it. Which, have we talked about the voice yet?
Not yet, no.
Okay, so that's interesting. But this might be a good, because they, are we still doing a synopsis? Where are we?
I think we've pretty much covered at least the first part. So, where we are in the movie, Paul Atreides, the House Atreides is betrayed by the Emperor, and they sent in the Sardaukar, I call them the Janissaries, the troops.
I call them the Mongolian throat singers because their language is derived from Mongolian throat singing.
See, that's the thing. Like, Orientalism is so fluid like that, and especially the American variety of Orientalism is that it's like everything else. It's a buffet where the world... is just, you take these details, like, oh, here's this Persian word, here's this Arabic word, let's take some Mongolian throat singing, let's throw that in with some, like, you know, these Bedouin clothing, you know, and like, it's just pure capital O Oriental, you know, it's just pure Orient. And that's why this movie is like, it's dripping in it. Like, it's, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, by taking out this sort of explicitly, okay, so in a movie like this, or a text like this, you're tempted to do the thing. It's really pedantic, but it's natural, so don't feel bad. But of drawing lines, you're like, oh, that represents this, like that represents that, like this represents that. But that's the thing. The authors of these kinds of texts have a free hand because it's all refracted through this like house of mirrors called Orientalism, where anything becomes anything. It just has to sound Oriental. And in this case, this is where what's interesting, and of course, this is why I had to be on this episode, even though I've been on so many episodes lately, is that the fusion of the indigenous settler colonial relationship, like the relationship between indigenous person and settler colonial, that's a universal relationship, right? Like that's like in North America, so-called North America, so-called, you know, like East Asia, like those are encounters between settler and indigenous person. So that you can extrapolate from, and that you can sort of like move. But where it gets messy is where the thing that all commercial movies have to do, which is align with the formulaic kind of narrative structure of like, okay, hero needs to go through a challenge and there needs to be like a love story and there has to be heroic death of someone meaningful. So like, it has to like check off those terrible sort of like whatever. And I can't imagine the novel is so movie-like that way, that the novel must be like full of extemporaneous details and the way that those genre novels, especially of that era, they really just, because you could just say anything, you could put anything and you're rewarded for it. You're like, oh, this guy's a genius. I mean, that's like what they did with the George R.R. Martin books. Like, that's why they got bigger and bigger, because you could just say stuff. It's your brain. You get to make it all up. It's fiction, right? Like, you could just let it run wild. So there is those things. But when it's run wild and it's only Orientalism, like it's just huffing and puffing its own Orientalist like origins, you get a text like Dune, where it's so nakedly Islamic. Like, it's just like this mishmash of like Islamic things because they sound Islamic. And like, you know, that's the strange thing. And so he did identify as an anti-imperialist, is what you were saying, though. I'm surprised to hear that, honestly, but I don't know enough.
He does identify as anti-imperialist and anti-colonialist. And if you read what he says about the books, that's what he was going for. But it's also it's a completely incoherent text because while he's deconstructing imperialism and colonialism, he's also contradicting his own deconstruction. So it becomes very manipulative in and he does, like Sina, you're absolutely right. He throws in all of these Orientalist tropes that you get to the point where your head is spinning round and round because you're not sure which one he's employing at any given moment, at any given time. And then in all of it, like, it comes back to this white savior myth, which we all know because it's with, as you said, with every single colonialist power, anywhere indigenous people have been colonized, you have this myth spring up. And sometimes the myth exists without even thinking about it because it's so ingrained in imperialist and colonialist societies.
I know plenty of hippies who think they're on the right side of history that, you know, end up playing Pocahontas, for lack of a better terminology, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, if Orientalism has been, like, your inheritance culturally, the center of your education, like, if, like, you've been taught, like, through the lens of white supremacy, of course, like, that's how a guy like Herbert exists. Like, he's a product of, like, American, like, you know, he watches the same six, you know, whatever. Like, it's all the same, like, the forces that bring people together as individual artists or whatever are historical. Like, we know that. You know, I did want to pull it back to the movie because I did notice some interesting things that are so classically Orientalist. So, like, that I wanted to get out the own holy text. This is obviously Edward Said's book. So one thing he says, that this is for the viewers at home. So this Arabic, this is all fake. It's all pseudo-Arabic. It just looks arabesque, as they say, right? Like, he couldn't have learned Arabic, right? The guy who did it was this guy Jean-Léon Gérôme. He was like this late 19th century painter. Or mid-19th century painter. When did Jérôme live? But so, like, it's a kind of example of how, like, you can just invent the Orient, and the detail of that, you don't really need it. It's just the aesthetics of it, how it renders it as this sort of object of, you know, like, exotic joy, right? And so there is this one thing, though, is that part of Paul, played by Timothy Chalamet, part of his own, at least from the movie, I mean, again, the book is different. I can't go back to the book because I haven't read it. I literally got through, like, one chapter. And I was like, I can't do this. I tapped out. And like 2 months ago. But there is this part where he clearly is interested in the colonized peoples of Arrakis, right? And he makes them an object of study, right? He learns about them. And there's this great line from, oh God, I lost it. I did this like three times. I prepared it, 92. Okay, it's Edward Said, Orientalism, page 93. And he's talking about a textual attitude, okay? A second situation favoring the textual attitude is the appearance of success. If one reads a book claiming that lions are fierce and then encounters a fierce lion, I simplify, of course, the chances are that one will be encouraged to read more books by that same author and believe them. But if, in addition, the lion book instructs one how to deal with a fierce lion and the instructions work perfectly, then not only will the author be greatly believed, he will be also impelled to try his hand at other kinds of written performance. There is a rather complex dialectic of reinforcement by which the experiences of readers in reality are determined by what they have read. And this in turn influences writers to take up subjects defined in advance by readers' experience. So a book, I'll finish it here. A book on how to handle a fierce lion might then cause a series of books to be produced on such subjects as the fierceness of lions, the origins of fierceness, and so forth. Similarly, as the focus of the text centers more narrowly on the subject, no longer lions but their fierceness, we might expect that the ways by which it is recommended that a lion's fierceness be handled will actually increase its fierceness, force it to be fierce, since this is what it is. And that is what, in essence, we know or can only know about it. Sorry, I'm losing my headphones. So that was something I definitely noticed in, like, the whole staging of Paul's encounter with the Oriental, because part of, as Elena explained, the story of this is about a kind of a colonial kind of change of hands. For whatever reason, this former party, Harkonnen, has been dispossessed of their ownership or stewardship, it's called, of this planet or whatever, and its resources, and it's been handed over to this other planet. And apparently, I learned this from a YouTube video, is that in the book, one of the reasons the emperor plots the downfall of whatever Jean-Bertrand Aristide family, whatever they're called, Aristocrats, Atreides, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, like one of the things that they were like, he was proving to be too popular or something. So like, this is a classic, like, oh, the good leader trope. Like, oh, I don't want, and this is like staged at the beginning. It's Oscar Isaac's character. I don't know who he is. He's always just Oscar Isaacs to me. But yeah, that is definitely, that's a definitely a neo-colonialist thing too, of like, oh, here's a good imperialist. Here's a different one than the one you're used to.
Absolutely. And that is, so and I think, so the Harkonnens are being moved out because of their treatment of the Fremen. Spice production has slowed. The Emperor also needs sort of a, he needs to exile Duke Atreides because he is getting too popular. So they move him to Arrakis. Also, if you look at Baron Harkonnen, which particularly in the Lynch version, but in this one as well, to me, he represents sort of imperialist excess and everything bad about capitalism. He is grotesquely fat. In the first one, he preys on young boys. Well, and he's got Sting oiled up in his underwear, his gold underwear. But he always seems to be vampiric in a way. He's drawing life essence from, if it's small animals or young boys. So he is like the absolute essence of imperialism and capital, consumer capitalism, and he has to be removed so that the good imperialist, the Atreides, can move in, and that we can make way for this messiah. So there's where you get this very effed up, trying to be polite in my language because our producer's here and I don't want him to have to cut it, but you have this really messed up view of colonialism. There actually are good colonial governments, good colonial powers versus bad colonial powers. And this one brings with it a messiah who's going to save the Fremen. And so it's this idea that Paul is going to go native. And again, you have this all, you know, this is like Dances with Wolves. This is like Lawrence of Arabia. This is, you know, he's going native, right? He even goes native to the extent where the Fremen, and this was something that really bothered me too, in the books and the movies, the Fremen, because they breathe in the spice and they're around the spice so much, their eyes turn blue, which is like this ideal of the indigenous people, that their eyes would be blue. And that bothered me in the books. It bothered me in the first movie. It bothers me in this, because it's this idea that's what they aspire to. So it's got this white supremacy along with this idea of only colonialists can save people from colonialism.
Well, so what's interesting is these movies are all supposed to be like encapsulating, you know, the settler ideal of, you know, this cool heroic tale of how they'll help out the natives ultimately overcome this bad imperialism, right? You know, I wish we had better words for bad imperialism, good imperialism, but that's, you know, the way it goes. You know, it's so simplistic in its construction, so it's really dumb, honestly, thinking about it. But I digress. You know, these movies, they only ever see themselves as allies in a position of power. You know, it's never, you know, some poor dude going native. It's always like, oh, I'm a soldier, or I'm, you know, I'm an imperial, you know, power of some sort, you know, in the hierarchy of power that has power over you, and I'm going to save you. And this, you know, interesting enough, you know, like, it's a man who's born into this position and the sorority of, you know, messiahship, you know, but the Fremen call their savior the Mahdi, and that's not till the end of the movie that he gets called the Mahdi, which is, you know, the doer. And so,
isn't it Mahdi? Isn't it like straight up Mahdi?
Yeah, so it's Mahdi, yeah. And then Muad'Dib is the name he chooses for himself, which actually means
maybe I'm combining the two. Yeah.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah, because Mahdi is obviously like a big important. It's like a, you know, it's a very, it's like a, it's just a straight up Islamic a term for. So yeah, they again, it's just like this naked overlay of Oriental like detail over this foreign place. That's just a way of kind of like borrowing difference and using it to signify alienness, right? But like, which totally tells you that like, oh, what your model of alienness is what you take from what you consider to be alien cultures, which are cultures here on Earth. So that's the interesting interplay in a text like Dune, is that you can negotiate the problems of Earth and the problems of like geopolitics with countries that aren't like yourself, right? And then you can, but you can do it in the freedom of this made up landscape, right? So that's, we were talking in the chat before about John Carter, right? John Carter is an obvious, like, right, based on the novel by Edgar Rice Burroughs, like another classic imperialist, like colonial author. The guy just straight up believed in like the white supremacy of like the British Empire and like created characters that like embodied it, right? Like physically, who could draw the energy. And that's, I mean, one of the creepy things about this, definitely is true what you said, Elena, is that like the racialization of blue eyes. And in general, just like, you know, like the fact that like, you know, the emperor is this like disgusting, corpulent monster. He's obviously, I think they did the same shot as in Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. Like, I think it's the same shot of him with his sweaty head. I think they just straight up copied that. So like which is itself was a kind of like a way of playing out, like Conrad's text was overlaid into Vietnam, right? And like, those are ways that we can keep a distance from like representing the like crimes of imperialism. So like a text like this is in a deep place, sort of in a deep way, maybe not conscious, but certainly in the kind of what you can call a political unconscious, to borrow a term from again, Frederick Jameson, is that it is negotiating the trauma inflicted over in countries like Iraq, in countries like Libya, right? Like the wars, the post 9/11 wars of the last 20 years that have, you know, killed 5 million more probably, and realistically, like, you know, displaced tens of millions, you know, like cost trillions of dollars in damage, destroyed whole countries. Like, this is a way of negotiating that guilt, like culturally. Like, it's a way of doing that. And it's so interesting that the whole, and this is, tell me if I'm wrong, but is the novel so obsessed with Paul and the Aristides, whatever House of Atreides?
The first novel, the first book is, but you actually, so Paul goes native. He does ultimately end up with the blue eyes, and he tames, or he rides Shai Hulub, which is the worm, which is the immortal being of the Fremen. And he marries Chani, who is the Fremen. I forget who plays her. What is her name? Thank you, Zendaya. But, and I don't want to ruin this for anyone who hasn't read the books, but he's not really a great husband, because further on down in the books, he actually marries the Padishah emperor's daughter. Imperialism will not be stopped, right? It's perpetuated throughout the books. And although the Fremen serve their purpose as being the indigenous people that need to be saved by the empire, they go on to serve a much smaller part in the future books. And you have your Messiah, and you have whatever comes from him. There's children of Dune. There's, of course, his sister who will be born and raised in Fremen, within the Fremen culture. But the underlying struggle between the colonial powers, those that support the Fremen and those that support the Empire, continue to war it out. There's the focus never changes. And the Bene Gesserits, who really are sort of both in the book movies, are always in the shadows. These very strong, manipulative group of women who use eugenics. And when I first saw this, I wondered how they were going to handle the Bene Gesserit, because of course, whenever you say eugenics in the 21st or 20th century, the first thing that comes to mind is what the Nazis did, and breeding and trying to create this super race or this super being. What is the difference between the Bene Gesserits and the Nazis, really?
Yeah, I did want to ask about something, which is like just at the level of like, you know, aesthetic movie, like formal stuff. Like there are so many like ham-fisted imperialist sort of U.S. war movie kind of cliches. There's like the Josh Brolin character who's like this ultra imperialist, like brutal soldier. And it's interesting, I have to say that even if this facade of Oscar Isaac's character, whatever, even with his facade of things that he does in his private moments when he's talking to Josh Brolin's character, he's like, oh, what is this hellhole, whatever. Like he's more honest about his imperialist intentions. And so the movie does demonstrate that, the sort of what we call kind of the fiction of the civilizing mission, how fictional it is, how flimsy it is as a pretext, because in the reality, it's about this stuff called spice. So there was that, but then there were just so many canned things, like what the locals call the hand of God. You know, just like, shut up, man. Like, what year is this? Like, what, you spent $200 million and you talk like that? Like, you couldn't come with like a better way? And everyone was so like, everyone was so overdrawn. Now, I know this is like a genre thing, that this is like, again, realism doesn't apply, so these aren't humans. However, in a movie like this, when the characters are inhabited by humans who are speaking English, who are like, who have like two, who are bipedal, who have like our shape of torsos, then yeah, it turns into like a human allegory of like, oh yeah, these are the powerful people who control the resources of this resource-rich country. So like your brain doesn't have to work to like make these connections, right? But in making those connections though, you're reinforcing all of these like corny and just tiresome, like cliched boomer. I mean, there has to be something about the boomerism of this book, because science fiction is a big boomer. If I know this, the like, it is kind of associated with that boomer. That was like its biggest era. I mean, until now, I guess, with its like kind of rescindence and kind of in the last 20 years. But it was a huge cultural touchstone for people who would have understood Dune in a certain way, and who would have watched the movie, the 84 movie, not with our cynical, you know, 2020 eyes, but with like, oh my God, it's like heavy metal, that Courtney magazine heavy metal. Like that kind of like that kind of like corniness, like just camp. You said it, actually. It's camp. Camp was not bad. We made it campy.
We did. Well, and think about, I mean, when the book was written in 65, when the first book was written in 65, like Star Wars was still, you know, a distant memory, or a distant, you know, in the future. And so I'm not sure that, I mean, this series of books was never going to be a Star Wars, because there's way too much in it. And like you said, Sina, it is very dated in its view of both the world as it was in the mid-60s, late-60s, but also in even any kind of futurism. I mean, there was just nothing that you could conceive of that would make this into a film. Like, I look at this now, and I think the coolest thing in the whole damn movie was the ornithopters. And, I mean, those were just amazing. Some of the cinematography was great, but we're still recycling all of these old tropes, and some of them are so bad that, yeah, like you just want to slap your face, because the dialogue, the acting, the people they put in these parts, like seriously, I mean, I love Jason Momoa, you know, in his gold underwear, that would be great. But, you know, first of all, like, why? You have House Atreides, which just codes white. They're going to be white, right? Because they're imperialist. They're this royal house. And Oscar Isaac's actually Guatemalan. There's that. Throw in someone of color, so Hollywood diversity, you know, people checking off the boxes don't get too ticked off at you. And then throw in Jason Momoa and you're good. But they, all of those houses are going to, regardless of whether they're the good colonizers or the bad colonizers, they all code as white. And then you have the Fremen, who are Zendaya. I don't know what her ethnic background is, but you have in the short time that you actually see the Fremen, you do have a number of people of color. I mean, they do look like they're a pretty diverse group, but they're all going to end up with blue eyes.
even if it doesn't align like with our understanding of white supremacy and imperialism, like the general logic of it does. So like even if it doesn't make sense to us, is that the racialization of like one of like the people in control versus the people who live under control, like that racialization is clear. And so that's what's really heavy-handed. I mean, it's not heavy-handed, but it is the gravity of the movie, is that you know who's the colonizer and who's the colonized, right? And the relationship is mediated through this, because and one thing is that like their actual role in spice cultivation is very non-existent, right? It's all made by machines and they're all off camera. So like even that kind of colonial relationship, it's like, oh, okay, so what are they doing here at all? Like in another, like this is a way of again, the sort of colonial encounter. However, because like at a certain level, however much you want to talk about this book, but there is a kind of colonial nostalgia animating this kind of book, because book or movie or whatever, because you are following around these people who have power, right? Like you are like following their perspective. You're put in their shoes, and their problems are like your narrative problem. Whereas clearly, and that's what the camera does. And of course, like that's the kind of people who made this movie. That's the culture that made this movie. It makes sense. Like it wouldn't have been made from a below. Now we could talk about Blade Runner actually, because that was his previous. That's one of the previous movies. And there's a lot there, and talks about, and a lot of saving thing about, you know, this underclass of people. In that case, that's a common thing too, is that they take the violence of slavery and they turn it into humans versus robots. They extract the race. They extract the white supremacy out of it. And they turn it in, they translate it into human supremacy. And there's this easy flux that just translates cleanly from that. And Star Trek Picard, which is that's what they can just imagine it. So that's the Star Trek Picard, this horrible show that I used to have a podcast about. They have this dystopian future where white supremacy is just human supremacy, right? That somehow all the 500 years of white supremacy has been sorted out. And we now teamed up like in some Disney movie against the real aliens, you know, like that is like one of the more criminal aspects of like these kinds of broad movies, where racialization is so vague, but always so present and intense and working on the story. Like if everybody was, let's say if everybody in this movie was black, was only, if this were like a purely African cast, it wouldn't read to us right. Maybe it would actually, because class you can signify in other ways, but because you could have done that with clothes and stuff. It could have just been like a kind of that didn't involve white supremacy. However, because it is overlaid in the present, it is a text of neocolonialism. It is written by a guy who was like watching like those famous Ed Wood corny sci-fi movies. Like that guy was obviously influenced by that culture. Like he went to 50s diners that were like alien themed, like that kind, and like Area 51, whatever, all that stuff. So like, it's easy to see the traces of this guy's thinking in this movie, even if I haven't read the book. But just the pure, like, he, like, raw, he just, like, takes it uncut, like, 100% uncut, like, you know, hashish orientalism, just, like, and smoking it pure, because it's just dripping. And it actually reminded me of, who are, like, the bad, obviously brown people of The Lord of the Rings, the ones who, like, collude.
The orcs.
The orcs.
No, those are, like, the people who... The people who collude with the orcs or the bad people. They're like, they have elephants. They like,
oh yeah. The
obviously South Asian, like correlative, whatever. Like it, that was another, that's what it reminded me of. Just like, again, just white man in the 50s, just dripping with race hate and orientalism, scribbling away at his imaginary landscape.
Exactly. I think now that you brought up Lord of the Rings, I think they were actually also sort of janissaries in that film. But when I watched this again, like my second time was more, this film is really a right wing white supremacist wet dream, because you've got the elite, the Harkonnen and the Atreides. You know that they're going to win whatever happens, that they're still going to rule the galaxy. Then you've got the indigenous people who really are in their place at this point, and they're all going to have blue eyes anyway. So they all basically have been controlled. Spice, the
the substance, whatever you want to refer to it, the psychedelic petroleum, is never going to belong to the Fremen. They may have their freedom in order to self-govern while they're being controlled by the state, but they're never going to be free from the state. So you can really see, and then you look at the military might of these two houses that are coming together to fight over this planet. And it really is, I'm just thinking of it's an advertisement for the NRA. It's really just white supremacy, white conservative, wet dream.
Yeah, this movie is mired in its own imperialist. I mean, the story too is that it's something that, and I think the nostalgia element of this is twofold, because there it's a book like this and a text like this, a story is written with a colonial nostalgia, like tapping into that. It's like, oh, it would have been nice if we just turned the clock back even 50 years, where we could tell those darkies of the earth what to do and what to do with their time and just like rule over them. Like that is, I think that is a deep-seated, very powerful sort of current of that runs to this day of like, and I think that I don't think that like all of the, you know, the Queen nostalgia, all the British nostalgia stuff, I mean, aside from being like a whitewash of like turning that incredibly violent and like, you know, genocidal history into like a salacious personal gossip sort of fiction that's kind of like embezzled, like of rich people, right? Like intrigue, social drama, like it's basically like reality TV, but fake. Right, like historical reality TV, that kind of vibe, but like
palace
like,
intrigue,
like that kind of stuff, just like boring ass, like look inside. But that colonial nostalgia is activated in this. But there's also the nostalgia of people like Elena who read this book when they were younger, who have good feelings about it, who like associated with like long trips to my grandma in the back of the car, who like have the childhood consumption of it, which is actually something that Star Wars does very consciously, like. The way that like, you know, new Coke recipe is calculated to like hit those exact centers of your brain. Like it's the same thing with these big franchises. They're calculated to extract as many emotions as possible. And so just the updating of Dune as this very expensive, like this was some expensive movie, I'm sure. I mean, it's Denis Villeneuve. The guy doesn't do anything for cheap. But so like that, so that itself is this own like investment in what this thing means. And this nostalgia, it is twofold. It's for the text and also for a time where, you know, these colonial politics were so open and naked, right? It wasn't unclear. I mean, this is what, 65, right? So we're in the middle of it in Vietnam.
Yep.
I was going to say, on the expensive part, they took 3 years to develop the worm. Like, yeah. To make it, like, biologically accurate to something that can exist.
The worm is the stupidest fucking thing, hackiest thing. The other hack thing was filming all the scenes with that horrible Middle Eastern brown yellow filter.
Well, so the worm actually comes from
so much.
The worm comes from Mongolian traditions, so like they're even borrowing like folklore from other Oriental cultures.
That's, there's a lot of worm stuff. Like, remember worms are in Beetlejuice. It's also in Tremors. Like
well, that's all deriving from Dune, though. You got to think about that.
That makes sense.
Yeah, like Tremors especially is Dune, just even more comedic, if you will, and set today.
Right. Interesting. Okay, so that I wondered about too. Right, because it is a kind of like obviously again heavy-handed metaphor for like the power of Mother Nature that only the indigenous person can harness because of their intimate connection to the earth. That was like
like the sand walking.
47,000. Yeah, like I was like, oh my god, this.
Well, I love the sand walking and then the thumpers, like where they, you know,
sand walk. That was the stupidest thing in the world. I was like, is this the Ministry of Silly Walks? Are we in Monty Python? Is that this dumb? Oh god, that was poison. That I was like, I gotta throw my remote at the TV. I'm sorry. That is the fucking dumbest thing on the planet. Of all the things to keep in the book. Because I'm sure so, most of the book, right? Like, the book is thick. It's detailed, rich.
Yeah, they didn't actually... I don't think they cut very much out of it, but...
The ending is actually really good as far as, like, depicting the book onto film.
Yeah, but this is... I mean, the great thing... And as I said, just because I loved this movie doesn't mean I actually loved the movie. I just loved all of the components of it because it screamed, like... Everything Sina has said and Chigwanatu has said, but also the crazy, scary thing about it is that it does appeal
to the liberals who are seeing this ecology element of it. And of course, the woman who, what was her name? Kynes. It was a man in the book. The first one who appears, that she's the black woman who dies. In the book, it was a man, and he is presented as half Fremen, but he has gone down a rabbit hole into the ecology of Arrakis. So there's this whole ecology element that appeals to liberals and can look at this movie and say, well, it's all about saving our Earth and about anti-extractive industries and about what they do to indigenous populations. And then, of course, the woman who represents that and represents that part of the Fremen is killed. But then you have this right-wing military, you know, only colonization can save the colonized kind of attitude, and this very, very pro-military, very rigid, you know, very fascist element, which is both Atreides and Harkonnen and the Empire. I mean, there's really thinly disguised fascism in all of the houses and in the Empire. So that's appealing to. I mean, like the producers of this and Villeneuve. They're appealing to everybody in this movie. Like, you can find something in it that's going to make you happy. Like, I loved the ornithopters. I thought they were really cool. But
well, I like the wetsuits and like the one scene where she gets stabbed, it sprays out like blood, and a sort of artistic representation of how water is the life force.
Water
of the
is life. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I kind of like that.
There's a lot of elements in it, and it appeals to a lot of different people, but it is. Yeah, it's, I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, I know that. I kept thinking like the gif of Jodie Foster being like, should have sent a poet. Like, I was just like looking like that with like Edward Said's face like overlaid onto that gif of like, so much Orientalism, should have sent a poet.
We can sum it up with, you named the Samoan guy Duncan Idaho. Duncan goddamn Idaho. Yeah. Might as well be like Duncan, Texas.
Yeah, I mean, that's because it's hard to manage all of those layers of like kind of narrative refraction where like the very real thing that we can understand of like, oh, this is a British person invading, you know, like the oil rich Middle East or whatever, right? Like your brain, they need to dress it up, because to like do a movie about that would be unpleasant. It would be aesthetically unpleasant because it would be about, you know, like stealing resources. So you have to dress these things up. And I find it interesting that we're at this moment now where, you know, you do have this kind of conflation of these different nostalgias, as I said, but also as oil is back to being this precious resource, like for a long time, it was so cheap, right? Like when I was like in high school, it was cheaper than Coca-Cola. Like that was like the lifetime that we like knew. And so, you know, like the 70s oil crisis that actually played a big role in Star Wars, like in the sort of like writing of Star Wars. And like George Lucas kind of admits to this in various different things, that like it was sort of spurned by this energy crisis that this movie kind of like forced, you know, could kind of like inaugurate, but I mean, it came out a couple of years ago, not even a couple of years ago, a year ago, I think, right? 2021. I mean, it was delayed by COVID, I think it was. So like it should have been out earlier, but you know, it is, you know, it's, we are coming to terms with these, with the fact that like, there's this precious resource that's controlled by these bad people. And, you know, we got to do something about that. And like, that's, you know.
Well, yeah, but see, this is such an old narrative, because this is like the narrative that was being put in 65. So, and then like, you look at like, oh, what was like organizing like back then, you know, you had the fish wars going on. As far as environmentalism goes, you had indigenous people organizing. That's really it. You know, people still weren't looking very closely. They were just escaping using science fiction.
Yeah.
And I think the next one, it'll be interesting. We'll have to come back if we can force Cena to watch another one. Because the next one, there's going to be that juxtaposition of spice and water. So you hear all about the water. There's never a drop of rain on Arrakis. And how did they survive by wearing these steel suits, which reconstitute sweat and urine and make it drinkable. And so water is obviously precious. And there's a scene in the Lynch version where you go into the Fremen
sort of gathering area, and there's just water everywhere. So there's this idea of the Fremen being the protectors of this water, but also their deity, for want of a better word, the worm, being the creator of this substance that everybody else in the galaxy wants. So it'll be interesting to see how they do that in the next film, how you have the juxtaposition of the water versus the spice, and no rain at all on Arrakis, and then Paul Atreides bringing rain.
Well, that might be a good place to wrap up. We probably drain this rock of as much blood as we can.
I think we did.
Dude is good enough as it is.
This is good. I'm glad I learned a lot from you guys, because I definitely was like in this place of like, oh god, I hate this movie, but I'm not educated enough to like make educated readings of it, because there is so much detail missing from it. But apparently it's a nice, in terms of translation from original text, he is kind of close.
He is. And I think that sometimes it's really great to hate something, because that's when you can really like rip the covering off of it and see where it came from. And Herbert, you know, there's some really messed up, you know, for someone who claimed or identified as an anti-imperialist and anti-colonialist, there's just, you know, there's just that you can't get away from it. As you said, Sina being raised in as a imperialist and a colonizer, it's impossible to get away from that. But it's interesting to sort of pull that layer by layer aside and see what's really down there.